Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Well, I know it's still summertime and you're not really thinking about winter yet, but on today's show, we're going to talk about cross-country skiing programs that are targeted specifically for the visually impaired.
We'll speak with Scott McCall, president of Ski for Light, about tips and tricks used to make cross-country skiing a safe and accessible sport for people with visual and other impairments. And towards the end, you'll learn how you too can participate. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Scott McCall.
I would encourage anyone who is looking for an organization where they can participate in an outdoor activity, enjoy winter sports, and also enjoy a community of individuals that is a very positive and upbeat, enthusiastic group. It's a great group to be a part of.
And cross-country skiing can particularly be a great sport. You know, in the winter, sometimes you get a little bit depressed because you're not going outside and playing in the warm sun. So this is a great sport you can do outside, and it'll keep you pretty warm. You don't even have to dress that warm, but it's a very active sport and exhilarating sport. And again, it gives you something to do outside in the winter that's a lot of fun.
And you can do it at any fitness level, from the equivalent of a stroll to the equivalent of running full tilt. And Scott, we'll talk about all sorts of options.
We've had lots of fun cross-country skiing over the years ourselves, and many fine stories as a result.
Let's start by meeting Scott McCall and learning about his involvement with Ski for Light before turning to the overall organization and its activities in the focus section.
I'm Scott McCall, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm currently retired from a 35-year career in vision rehabilitation, and I thank you for this opportunity to talk with you and your audience about a program and an organization that's a big part of my life, and that is Ski for Light.
Many of our listeners have visual impairments. Do you?
I do. I'm totally blind. I've been blind all of my life and have grown up with adapting to the world as a blind person. And that was my career also, working in the field of blind rehabilitation.
And what's your current position with the organization?
I'm currently serving as president of Ski for Light in my second year of this term, and I've been on the board actually two different times, and this is my second term as president.
And how did you first get into skiing?
Back in 1981, I was working at the Center for the Visually Impaired in Atlanta, and a gentleman from Seeing Eye, David Liu, who many of your listeners may know, David for many years was a representative from Seeing Eye. David was in Atlanta introducing some of our clients to the Seeing Eye program. And he was telling me about his experience at Ski for Light in 1981. And he made it sound like something that I thought I would like to try. I had grown up in the South, had never been around much snow, and really didn't expect to still be doing it some 35 years later. But my first Ski for Light was in 1982 in South Dakota, and I've been to 31 Ski for Lights, missed three along the way.
Cool. Well, our first run-in with Ski for Light was we were visiting our son, who used to live and work in the mountains of Colorado. He was working in Keystone, which is in Dillon, and so we were staying there, and we walked to Frisco for lunch. It's a really long walk. It's 7 miles from Dillon to Frisco. And as we got into Frisco, we saw the statue of the blind skier and the sighted guide. And we thought, oh, how cool is that?
We certainly burned off lunch that day.
several times.
You know, I had the pleasure last summer of visiting in Frisco and my first visit to see that statue. And of course, the first Ski for Light event was in 1975 in Frisco.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is all about Ski for Light, the organization, its history, and the programs they offer.
Can you tell us how Ski for Light got started?
Sure. Our roots go back to Norway. In the late 50s and early 60s, a very popular musician who was blind, Erling Stordal, developed a concept of skiing in tracks, and he promoted that to some members of the Norwegian government and others in Norway. And in 1964, the first, really the Norwegian Ski for Light, which is called the Ritteren, was started. In the 1973, a Norwegian-American, Olaf Pettersen, who was a ski instructor in Colorado, wanted to bring the concept of teaching people who are blind to cross-country ski. So Olaf used his contacts from Norway, and he also was a close friend of Erling Stordal. And he worked with the Sons of Norway Foundation, which is based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and local members of the Lions Club in Summit County, Colorado, and other volunteers. And in 1975, the first event was held in Frisco. And the idea caught on both with visually impaired skiers and sighted guides. And the next year it was held in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it's continued every year. We celebrated our 40th year anniversary last year back in Colorado. And we've only had one cancellation in 1984. We were scheduled to go to Lake Placid, New York. And about 10 days before the event, there was a week or so of rain. And the snow was all gone, and it was all mud and water. And so the event was canceled at the last minute. But otherwise, we've had Ski for Light every year.
What's a typical week like if somebody shows up day one? What would they expect?
We first official activity of the Ski for Light week is dinner on Sunday evening. However, prior to dinner, people have flown in usually to a major airport. For example, last year in Colorado, most people flew into the Denver airport. We arrange transportation to transport the group from the airport to the ski venue. And people get settled Sunday afternoon, and at dinner, people are getting acquainted. And following dinner, part of a regular activity is to announce the match of a blind skier with a sighted guide for the week. And that instructor guide will be their partner for the entire week.
And then they start skiing on Monday?
On Monday morning, they get their skis. If they don't have skis, we arrange for people to have skis that we rent. They get fitted and then start learning the basics of cross-country skiing. But we start out with some indoor exercises to get accustomed to the equipment and some of the basic body positions. But generally by after lunch, everyone's out on the snow. And then it's a matter of how far and how fast a person wants to progress.
Now, people undoubtedly come with different levels of skill and different levels of athleticism. How do you handle that?
One of the nice things about cross-country skiing is it can be done at so many levels. I think oftentimes when people hear the phrase cross-country skiing, they think that it means skiing very fast or down up very steep hills, and it can mean all of those things. But it also can be similar to taking a stroll through the woods on a beautiful winter day. So it can be done at a leisurely pace, or it can be done at a very invigorated pace.
And what's the rest of the week like after you get people off to a good start on Monday?
Throughout the week, the blind or mobility impaired individual and their guide work on various ski techniques to improve their skiing, to work on things like balance, going up hills, going down hills, gliding along the flat areas. And then it's a matter of just working to improve one's skill and also endurance. Cross-country skiing is a wonderful outdoor exercise. It's a wonderful aerobic exercise. And one does have to have a certain degree of endurance to be able to ski, you know, for a reasonable length.
What special considerations are there when you're taking a visually impaired person cross-country skiing? I would imagine, for instance, just leading them or having them follow you might be a little bit special.
Yeah, really, the guiding process is special. And we have a training program for first and second year guides. Many of our guides have guided for 10, 15, 20 years, but each year we have anywhere from 8 to 15 new guides who come to Ski for Light, and we train them on the weekend, for example, on Saturday prior to the group assembling on Sunday. Those new guides would go through a evening, and then on Sunday, a full day of training. The way cross-country skiing occurs is tracks or grooves are set into the snow by a track-setting machine. So I would have a pair of tracks, and my guide would be in parallel tracks several feet off to my left. And the guide gives verbal instructions and directions, and also can provide some commentary about the countryside and the surroundings. And the visually or mobility impaired person generally just follows the direction of the guides. And once a person gets more experience and more comfortable on skis, and when the tracks are good, it's almost like a self-guided experience. It can go for 100 or so yards, and the guide really doesn't have to give any information because the tracks are somewhat guiding you.
There's a lot of tactile feedback there in the tracks.
It really is. You learn, I think, through experience to pay attention to what your skis are telling you in terms of the sound and the feel of the tracks and the snow, whether the snow is firm and fast or icy or soft and more difficult to traverse.
But that's a great idea, having the parallel tracks. When I had a little bit more vision, I used to follow in back of Nancy in just a single set of tracks, and she would wear something bright. As my vision declined, then I would go in front, and she would try to guide me from the back. And every once in a while on a turn, the tracks weren't so good, or sometimes I would start going a little bit too fast, and I would get out of voice range. I couldn't hear over the sound of the skis and the snow. And then it was like flying a remote control plane when it got out of range of the controller.
Right. That's very, very true and very much part of skiing. And we do have a number of participants who still have some vision, and they will choose, you know, it's easier to follow their guide, just as you described. So that's part of it also.
Yeah, the other thing with the two of us is that Pete's a much better athlete than I am. And once he started going in front with me behind giving him verbal input, he would frequently get out of range and I would be huffing and puffing trying to keep up with him. And then I'd have to muster all the breath I could and just yell, you know, stop. If he kept going, it was just going to be in a straight line no matter what was in front of him, and that could include trees, so I didn't want to see that happen too often.
It's very important for the visually impaired skier and the guide to stay within voice contact. And we've had people get away from one another occasionally, and generally it's worked out okay, but an occasional crash.
Yeah, usually it's not too dangerous because you fall into soft snow, although you do have to watch out if you're wandering through wooded areas that you don't smash into a tree if you get off course.
That's right, exactly.
My most nervous time skiing was going downhill. You know, you couldn't control your speed as much as you'd like to, and, you know, your sense of direction may have been thrown off a little bit because the tracks weren't as deep or as well-defined.
You know, I think there's a fine line in going downhill between the exhilaration of the, you know, building up speed and that sense of freedom, but not going over the edge where you lose control. And most of us have had that experience of going over the edge and losing control, and you know, falling is certainly a part of cross-country skiing. We spend a lot of time with new skiers teaching some techniques to control speed on hills, because particularly for a novice skier, that can really be a frightening experience of feeling out of control going down the hill. But once a person has mastered some of those techniques to control speed and developed balance, then it becomes part of the exhilaration.
There's also a fair degree of trust involved. You know, I was never that nervous if I knew I was in a wide area with no trees or rocks. And even if I went downhill, you know, what's going to happen to you? But if it was a more dense area with trees and rocks, it takes a fair amount of trust to rely on the person giving you correct directions and telling you about the potential hazards in front of you.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I think that's one of the key elements to a good partnership between the visually impaired skier and the guide. I've really been impressed over the years of how quickly that trust relationship generally develops. And you're right, it's a key to a successful week.
Do you coach the guides and the blind participants on establishing trust relationships? Because it really is a person-to-person interaction there.
We do. We talk a lot about partnerships in Ski for Light. And we have a emergency command that we emphasize to the blind skiers and the guides, and that is sit. And if the guide senses that there is danger, or if the skier gets out too far ahead of the guide, or there's any cause for serious concern, the guide is to say or shout the word sit, and the skier, the visually impaired skier, is to drop down immediately, and then you can ask the questions and talk about it later. And we actually practice that. We encourage at the beginning of the week for the visually impaired skier and their guide to go out and practice having the guide issue the sit command, and the visually impaired skier drops down immediately.
That's probably a lot more effective than my emergency word, which was, yo.
Yeah, right.
That's all I could get out when I was huffing and puffing. And he knew if I did that, he'd better stop.
And I usually sat, especially if I was going downhill.
Right. Or watch out. Or there are a lot of things. And sit seems to be an easy one. It comes out quickly, and it tells you exactly what to do.
Now, getting back up from a seated position in an awful lot of fresh powder isn't all that easy. I assume you also teach people how to get up once they're sitting in the snow.
We do. We have a progression that we take people through, usually the first day of learning some of the basic body positions, some of the stepping exercises. And one of those progressions is getting up from a fall. And because it's so easy when you go down, your arms are flailing, your one leg goes one way, the other goes the other way, your skis get tangled up. Sometimes a ski comes off, a pole may come off.
Been there, done that.
Oh, and it's so complicated if you happen to be in a deep snowbank. And oftentimes people struggle so much and use up so much energy getting out of the snowbank. So we do teach people getting up from a fall, and that usually works, although it doesn't always work. We've all, you know, gone into those snowbanks head first or feet first and really struggled to get out.
But I assume you haven't lost anybody over the years.
Not to our knowledge. We do a count at the end of the week, and so far, so good.
Now, we very carefully selected the date for airing this episode to be in August, and people may think we're crazy for having done that because there's no snow anywhere except at the tops of mountains in North America in August. Can you explain why it was important to time this episode that way?
Sure. Thinking about skiing helps one cool off in August down here in Atlanta. But seriously, August is when our real push starts for recruiting and attracting new people and old friends alike to Ski for Light. And it takes sometimes several weeks or months for a person to actually make the decision. Do I really want to try this? It may mean talking with some other people who have attended Ski for Light, doing some research, certainly saving some money, making travel plans. So we put our applications up on our website in early August, and it's the time when we really start pushing for recruitment of both visually and mobility impaired skiers, as well as for new guides, because we can't have Ski for Light without our instructor guides.
Speaking of your website, it says that this winter's ski week will run from Sunday, January 24th through Saturday, January 30th, 2016, right?
That's right, exactly. In the past, we have run a Sunday to Sunday event. And this year we are trying, for a variety of reasons, we're testing out a one-day shorter event. And we will be in Bear Lair, Michigan, at a resort called Shanty Creek Resort, which is a group of hotels. There's cross-country skiing trails. There's downhill skiing there, which we don't participate in, but it's a general winter resort area.
Now for this week's final item, how you can get more information about Ski for Light, including how you can participate.
And how can people find out more about these trips, the organization, and sign up for one of these trips?
The very best way is to visit our website, www.sfl.org. That's www.sfl.org. Can find all of the information, a lot of history, information about the organization, a little bit about how we function. Ski for Light is an all-volunteer organization that's managed by a board of directors. So there's some information and background on the organization. There's a link to a video that's very well narrated. We shot that in 2013. And there's information about past events. So it's a wealth of information in a very accessible website, www.sfl.org.
Now, if people had questions, is there a phone number or an email address where they can ask questions?
I'm going to give my phone number because we're incorporated in the state of Minnesota and we have an answering machine in an office that we use. But if someone needs to reach us by phone, you could call me, Scott McCall, at area code 404-702-5739. That's 404-702-5739. And you could also email info@sfl.org.
And who is this open to? What kind of age ranges people attend and what kind of experience level is expected?
We serve adults. We're not a children's program. So 21, 22 is probably the youngest we have had. On up to, we have one participant who is aged, I think, 93. So that complete range. Experience is not necessary. In fact, part of our mission is to introduce cross-country skiing to people who have never participated in the activity. We generally have about 100 visually and maybe 6 to 8 mobility impaired. So no experience is necessary, and generally about 20 to 25% of our attendees have no experience or attending for their first time, and the remainder are people who have been for anywhere from a few years to over 30 years. So it's a good mix.
So you were talking about the international heritage of this organization. Is Ski for Light nowadays mostly available in North America, or are there other Ski for Light organizations around the world?
There are others. Canada has a very active Ski for Light or ski program. Norway, where this all started, has an event each year, the Ritteren, which is the Norwegian Ski for Light. And that attracts upwards of 800-900 people, maybe 1,000 people from all over the world. There are Ski for Light programs in other countries. We're an international organization also. We, last year, I think, had 6 different countries represented. So there really is an international flavor to the event, and that adds to the cultural enjoyment and benefits of a Ski for Light week.
If people don't want to make their first ski trip a major journey to this week-long event, and they wanted to find something maybe shorter, maybe closer to home, how would they do that?
People can look on our website at regional programs to find something in their local area that might be a good way to get an introduction to cross-country skiing.
Well, that sounds like a great way to be active, do something fun, and meet other people.
All of the above.
And as usual, if you missed any of that contact information, it's all available in our show notes at www.eyesonsuccess.net. Try it out, give them a call, and maybe you can go on one of their ski journeys with them.
That's it for show number 1534. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about NVDA, non-visual desktop access. We'll be speaking with Jamie Tay, one of the founders and lead developers of this free open source screen reader for Windows. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. Browse the full archive of programs, find instructions for subscribing to the podcasts, and much more at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also find us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com, at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at _EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.